Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Although Hidden Figures didn't win any Oscars on Sunday, the film has had a powerful cultural resonance and might even have an effect on the way students relate to math and science in the future. But there are still many hurdles that students in low-income areas face, even if they are math or science prodigies. In a recent article in the New York Times headlined Beyond Hidden Figures, Nurturing New Black and Latino Math Whizzes, Amy Harmon wrote about a program called BEAM that nurtures kids who love math, and she profiled some of its attendees from last summer. I'm very pleased that she's come here on our show and brought along two of the students who are enrolled in the program, JJ and Tice, and then later we'll be joined by MBR. Welcome to our show.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Amy, what led to the creation of BEAM, the bridge to enter advanced mathematics?
Well, I think it was the realization that that there are Blacks and Latinos are vastly underrepresented in the higher echelons of science, what's called STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And one of the reasons is that increasingly, even if you get, you go to a great school, you need extracurricular. There's a whole extracurricular ecosystem that I didn't know existed, but that really does exist for kids that are quite young. So to achieve high levels of success in these, in the STEM fields, you really need to be going to, math camp and Saturday math classes, and from quite a young age. Not everybody does, but that's, yeah.
And so, wasn't the founder of BEAM rather young? He was a graduate student at MIT.
He went to MIT. His name is Dan Zaharopol. He went to MIT as an undergrad, and he was going to graduate school. And some people, actually, it's a couple of hedge fund. One was an ex hedge fund millionaire. One is a current hedge fund millionaire, Sandor Lachowski. He's at Jane Street Capital. Came to him and said, we are concerned about this. We have a little bit of money. They didn't have a ton of money, but we are concerned about this disparity in in finance as well. And we think this is one of the reasons. They were actually ex math team champions themselves. And, would you be interested in starting this?
So how long ago was that?
So that was, I think, 6 years ago. And they ran a program for 5 years for kids that were going into the eighth grade, a one summer long program. And they, what they do is they go to schools that have predominantly low-income populations, and they give them a test. They give the schools select their best students, and then those students are given a test, and then BEAM selects the best of those. So these guys are, did pretty well on that test, and then they have a summer program that gives them exposure it's not remedial math. Like, this is advanced math. And it's a kind of math that a lot of kids, wouldn't get until college, but that kids who go into STEM fields are getting when they're quite young.
JJ, how old are you?
I'm 12.
And where do you live?
In Kingsbridge, Bronx.
In the Bronx?
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of these kids come from the Bronx.
From the Bronx, from Brooklyn. They came from all over, yeah.
How many siblings do you have?
Three.
And are they all like math?
Only my big sister seemingly cares about math. My two other siblings are young, so they're not that exposed to it. So.
But what if it wants to be an astronaut, JJ, right? I think Kai wants to be an astronaut.
Then that would require some math studies as well. When did your school select you to take the test for BEAM?
Somewhere around, in early summer, in late spring.
And were you nervous to do it?
Yes.
Have you always done well in math?
Not always.
But you hid your acceptance letter from your mother. Why?
Because when I first saw it, I was thinking, I'm going to spend my entire summer doing math, and only math, instead of doing other things like that I wanted to do.
Like karate.
Yeah.
So what happened when your mother found the letter, the acceptance letter?
She automatically made me go.
Tyce, do you live in the Bronx as well?
Yeah, I do.
Do you like math?
I love math. Yeah, I love math, and I wasn't always good at it, but then when I started being good at it, I started to like it more.
I'll bet you didn't hide your acceptance letter.
I didn't. We actually didn't, we didn't get the acceptance letter the same time that all the other students did, and that's because my dad was kind of worried, but then when I found out that I was accepted, I first wanted to go to my school summer camp, but then I decided to go to BEAM, so, you know, I'm glad for that.
And when did you meet JJ?
I met JJ on the first day. It was like we were at the subway station, and they were waiting for me, and I went to the subway station, and then he, like, automatically introduced himself.
So you became friends on the subway.
Yeah.
What kinds of, I throw this out to both of you, what kinds of math problems did you learn at BEAM? JJ?
We learned things like how to, like, divide and multiply fractions and stuff like that. We, like, learned really hard stuff.
Stuff that you wouldn't have learned in regular school?
No.
Tyce, what did you think when you met JJ? A kindred spirit?
Yeah. First, like, I could tell that he was going to be that kind of person that would, like, you know, just automatically, you know, want to become friends with you. And then he would, like, just, like, you know, always bother you, but always in a good way. Like, you know, just only to let you know that he'll be there.
What was the hardest class at the camp?
It was probably the geometry class that I took, because I didn't really like geometry at that time, but BEAM allowed me to practice geometry. That's how come I started liking geometry more.
But Amy, wouldn't they be taking those kinds of courses in high school?
In high school, maybe, but they're in middle school. And so I think that the sooner they get exposure to kind of some of what BEAM covers is kind of basic, because their schools, you know, is a little bit spotty. They have to sort of fill in some of the basics so that they can get to this more advanced kind of logical reasoning. And I think that's one of the things that I learned, was that, you know, we have this idea of this mythology of the you know, the natural math genius. But you actually, you know, to be good at math, you need to actually get exposure to math and do math. And that's what they were doing.
Well, I was the opposite, the naturally not good at math genius. We have Amir on the line. Hi, Amir. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
You also from the Bronx?
Yes.
Hi, Amir.
We're really close to Taiz and JJ.
Have you always liked math?
As long as I can remember, I really liked math, so yeah.
What are some of the things you've learned at math camp?
I learned there were these really hard problems in one of my math classes. They had to do with, like, fractions. They had to do with fractions, like, multiplying and dividing fractions inside fractions. And it was really hard. And we also learned, like, insolvable problems that they ran on forever. So...
Can you explain what you learned about binaries?
Taiz,
once on the way home, she showed us, like, one of her problems about that had, like, binary. So, like, we had to ask her, like, 3 or 4 questions, and she would say yes or no, and once she could lie. So
you kids are teaching each other math to some degree?
Yeah.
They didn't all take the same classes. There were many classes at the camp. So Thais was in a class called Codes, 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 right? And where you learned something called the Hamming Code?
Yeah, I learned binary, the Hamming Code, and Morse Code.
And it sounds to me like you meet it either on the subway or in the camp, and you become friends. Are you all friends now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're still close. I still talk to JJ over the phone, and Amir, I would see him in some of the activities that the founder of Beam would recommend us to go to.
I'm speaking with JJ and Thais and Amir, along with Amy Harmon, who have wrote an article for the New York Times called Beyond Hidden Figures, Nurturing New Black and Latino Math Whizzes. Amy, who teaches at this program?
It's a mix of really experienced math teachers who teach middle school and high school and some math PhDs. I mean, they try to recruit instructors who are, you know, really well qualified. But, you know, you mentioned their friendship because that was one of the – so I went to this camp and I thought, well, I'll spend some time here and I'll write a story about the question really was, you know, are for kids who for whom math is not, as one instructor put it, in the air. Like, for some kids, they grow up and if their parents have a, you know, have an advanced degree in math or science, or their teachers identify them young, or they go into honors classes, or they're in a community where it's just kind of the norm to go to Saturday math classes, that math is in the air. That's not true for these kids. So the question was, could these kids really get hooked into math? And I thought I would see them learn math and see whether that would happen. But one of the most interesting things for me was seeing their friendship become the thing that really hooked them into math. So I got to see these guys kind of
get
to like each other.
Funding for research in math, engineering, and physical sciences goes almost exclusively to white and Asian American kids.
Well, I say that because those are the people who are getting advanced degrees in math.
It's because of the schools that they go to? Is the problem that kids aren't going to these camps, or that the schools in the Bronx aren't doing the job they should be doing?
Well, so I would say that it's both. It's some of both. And I think that we are pretty well aware of the problem of education inequality, and that there are schools that are, you know, less well-funded schools, and schools in poorer neighborhoods get less, you know, have less resources. What I thought was interesting is to realize that even in the best of schools, you're not going to get the kind of math education that a lot of kids who are succeeding in STEM fields are getting, because they are also going to these extracurricular programs. And so I think, you know, these kids, yeah, they go to school in the Bronx, but their public schools are pretty good. So I don't actually think that's so much the issue here.
Well, JJ, do you ever have feel like you know more than your math teacher in school?
Nope.
You haven't gotten that far.
No.
Thais?
Well, it's this joke that my teacher and I have that that's why he gets, like, in quotations, upset with me, because sometimes when he would like have a problem on the board and then he would solve it, I would be like the only one with my hand raised. Wait, that's not the answer. The answer is this. And then he'll be like, no, I know more. And I'm like, just check the answer again. And then he'll be like, okay, fine, you're right. And then that's the joke that we have. And mm-hmm. That's what he tells the other classes, why he's always upset with me.
Now, I'm assuming that you're being taught practical math, not theoretical mathematics. This is math so that these kids can actually go out and get jobs using mathematics.
It's all what Beam actually tries to do is teach them more about kind of what mathematicians would tell you is like at the heart of mathematics, which is logical reasoning, creative problem solving. Yes, they have to know their fractions, and so they're right now kind of building up a base. But that's actually one reason I started out saying that Beam formed 5 years ago and it's been going on for 5 years. But this is the first year, and the reason that I wanted to write about it is that this is the first year that they've started with kids that are a year younger, because they kind of decided they were helping kids, but one summer was nowhere near enough to kind of get them to the level of their more affluent peers. So these kids started going into seventh grade. And a big question for me through the fall and winter until just last month was whether they were going to stick with it and whether they would want to apply, especially JJ, who definitely didn't want to be there last summer, whether he would really, you know, have gotten hooked on math enough and or maybe care about seeing his friends enough, or for whatever the reason was, to apply for a second summer.
So what's the answer, JJ? Have you decided you prefer math to karate camp?
Well,
I'll be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of.
What about you, Amir? Has this inspired you to think more about what you might do with the math that you're learning?
Yes, definitely. It's definitely done something to how I think about math.
What about other things, like preparing you for standardized tests in general?
Well, sorry, but the way that Beam taught me how to like answer problems in ways that the schools would normally not teach you, I think it will probably give me the edge when it comes to like the math standardized test. Yeah.
Thais, are there as many girls in the camp as there are boys?
Well, I would say there would be an equal amount of boys to girls because even though like girls are more like interested in the math, there were still the same amount of boys and girls.
Although in the past we might have said that it would be disproportionately the other way. I mean, are things changing?
Well, girls are doing, yeah, girls do really well in math through middle school and especially...
They just have to be encouraged.
Yes, they do.
Aren't there other extracurricular math programs and math camps that already exist, like MathPath?
MathPath is a, yes, there are, well, that's what I learned about is this whole extracurricular ecosystem that does exist. But MathPath is an exclusive, is a camp that you have to take a test for, and it's almost exclusively been, and the enrollment has been almost exclusively white and Asian. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what the point of BEAM is to prepare these kids to enter programs like MathPath or Math Camp USA, or there are these other programs or to participate in math teams that compete nationally and internationally.
What are some of the biggest challenges that BEAM has faced since it was launched? Has it been hard to get kids excited about going to the camp?
No. And, you know, that's one thing that I think you sometimes hear or that I have heard in reporting this story. People will say, well, oh, you know, these communities, it's just their culture, you know, essentially that they're not the tiger moms and they're not pushing their kids. But as soon as all of the parents that I spoke to, as soon as they heard about this camp, were on it. They wanted their kids to go there. It's not hard to get kids.
Well,
to
obviously, work. JJ's mother wanted to go there. What about you, Thais? Your mother a tiger mom?
My mom, she's, the thing is that she, my dad is more about the math. My mom, she would just want the best for me. So she knows that whatever my dad is saying about the education, she would like look at it and then she'd be like, I think I know what is best for Thais.
And are you going to go back to the camp next year?
Oh yeah, of course.
And what about you, JJ?
Mm-hmm.
And Amir?
Of course I will. I definitely want to go to the camp.
I'm sure there are other things at the camp that are attractive. What else do you do at the camp, Amir?
Besides math, we would have activity time where we would do things that we would like have hands-on activities like board games, drums, and like trips. Like, once we actually went on a boat throughout the East River, it was really fun.
Well, it's been such a pleasure having the four of you here, Amir, by phone. We've been talking with Thais Garcia, Jonathan Jackson, also known as JJ, Amir Willis, and with Amy Harmon, whose article in the New York Times, Beyond Hidden Figures, Nurturing New Black and Latino Math Whizzes, inspired us to invite all of you to our show. It's been such a pleasure having you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Eight years ago, for the first time in human history, the world officially became more urban than rural. In her new book called The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative, award-winning science journalist Florence Williams looks into what effect this move away from nature, along with the majority now living in cities, may have on people throughout the world, and asks, is nature more of a luxury or a necessity? It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Florence Williams to our show. Welcome.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Didn't you grow up in New York City?
Yes, I did.
Did you go to the parks a lot?
I did. You might think I am not so nature connected, but, you know, New York has amazing public parks. And I grew up on the Upper West Side, so a few blocks from Central Park, and I spent tons of time there. It's still one of my favorite places to get a nature fix.
But you say your father played a role in your connection to nature by taking you all over the country.
He did, yeah. My father was a major wilderness guy. He really looked like the grape nuts man. And every summer we would load up a van with canoes on the top and drive out west and go into the wilds.
That's not what you did to research this book.
Not so much. I really spent some time in labs. I spent times on many continents with people who were actually trying to be healed in nature, sort of a combination of reporting and then also talking to the scientists.
And looking at how different cultures approach nature as a form of healing and a form of making people happy. You went to Japan. What is the biophilia hypothesis?
The biophilia hypothesis was really popularized by Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson, and it really posits that humans evolved in nature with a natural affinity to bond with living things. And because of that, we feel on some subconscious level often just at home in the wilds, but if we don't cultivate it as children, we can actually lose that sense of affinity.
Doesn't Japanese culture include a number of nature rituals?
It does. There's a kind of an eccentric, interesting practice that I was researching called Shinrin Yoku, or forest bathing. And it's a way to get very stressed out Japanese people into the woods. You know, Tokyo it's industrialized very intensively. There's an incredible work ethic there. People sometimes literally drop dead on the job. And so forest bathing is something that the government is really promoting.
But people are not actually bathing. This is a
right.
Metaphorical bathing?
It's metaphorical bathing. You can keep your clothes on. And it involves really just opening up all of your senses and engaging all of your senses while you're in the woods.
But Japanese culture also includes celebrating cherry blossoms every spring.
That's right. And bonsai, you know, there are many, many ways that the Japanese have integrated nature into daily life.
Who's Yoshifumi Miyazaki?
He's an amazing psychologist and researcher in Japan who has really done a lot to try to measure the physiological effects. What happens to your brain? What happens to your body when you go into the woods? And what he's documented is even just 15 or 20 minutes of being in natural areas can lower your blood pressure, lower your cortisol stress hormones, increase your feelings of mood and vitality, and decrease your feelings of frustration.
Can you walk us through some of the tests done to measure the effects of sound and smell in the brain?
Yes. Well, smell is an interesting one. The Japanese love their sort of Hinoki cypress forests, which are these very pungent, wonderful smelling evergreen forests, sort of like a combination of a Christmas tree and Vapo Rub. And they've documented that even if you're in a hotel room that's misting the essential oils from these trees, your blood pressure drops and your natural killer immune cells increase. And they've documented this, too, in people who walk in the woods as opposed to people who are walking in a city. So it's not just an exercise effect of feeling better. Well, and the effects last, you know, they say about 7 days.
When city people go out of the city, often one of the first things they say is, take a breath, smell that fresh air.
That's right. There's something about being outside that really does make you want to open up your senses. You know, the smells are unlike being in the city where we sort of learn to close off our senses.
You also went to South Korea. Now, South Korea and Japan have all sorts of cultural connections, but do they have a different approach? They have these forest healing programs.
Yeah, the South Koreans, I think, have taken the Japanese idea and medicalized it to an extent that's even richer. And so they've designated about a couple of dozen healing forests, and there are 500 healing rangers that have been trained by the South Korean Forest Agency. And these healing rangers take groups of people. I ran into a group of firefighters with PTSD, and they were doing yoga on platforms in the woods. And they said that this was just, you know, an amazing way for them to kind of begin to recover from just the trauma and stress of their jobs.
There's also, there are programs in this country if for people with PTSD, veterans, the higher ground, which takes them into nature.
That's right. These programs, for the most part, are not kind of sanctioned yet by the Veterans Administration. They're run by nonprofit organizations, by other veterans who have experienced this personally in their own lives and kind of want to share it. I spent time on the river, on the main fork of the Salmon in Idaho, which is in the middle of the largest wilderness in the lower 48. This was a group of women veterans with PTSD. We went on this trip for about 6 days, and it was just amazing to me to watch them, watch these women who'd been through so much, you know, traumatic brain injury, trauma, just really come out of their shells and kind of experience awe and the mind-opening consequences of that.
So you think that it is because they're experiencing nature rather than just bonding with other people who have had similar experiences?
That's a great question. I think it's very hard to tease out exactly what the mechanisms are. Is there something about the nature itself? Some researchers say, hey, you know, I think it's because of fractal patterns found in nature. That's really why your alpha waves are, you know, highlighting your brain.
That's what the neuroscientists
say? That's what some of the neuroscientists say. They're actually finding ways to measure brain waves, do imaging that shows, you know, where the brain activation is going in different environments. But I think you're right. There's something about nature that also facilitates activities that we know are great for mental health. And one of those is social bonding. Another is exercise. And another is just really being away and in a novel, you know, kind of stimulating environment.
What are the attention restoration and stress reduction theories?
The attention restoration theory was really posited by Rachel and Stephen Kaplan in the 1970s. And they were among the first scientists to really look at this question. And what they noticed was that people who were depressed and were spending time in nature felt better. And so the attention restoration theory posits that there's something about their frontal lobes. Like all of our frontal lobes get sort of overworked and overtaxed in daily life. That's the part of our brains that are, you know, task-oriented, checking off our to-do list, reading our emails. But, you know, we didn't really evolve to sort of hyper-work that frontal lobe as much as we do now. And so when we go into nature, suddenly our attention really is distracted by what we're seeing on the trail or what we're seeing in the trees or in the landscape or what we're hearing. And it actually rests that task-oriented part of our brains so that it comes back stronger later on.
So should we be worried about people who don't spend much time in nature?
I think we should be. There are certainly other ways to de-stress. You know, meditation is terrific, listening to a fantastic opera, viewing artwork. But what worries me is that we are now facing an entire generation of children who are fundamentally disconnected from nature. They're spending vastly less time than their parents did. We know that mothers, when I was growing up, say 79% of them say that they were outside every day as children. And their children, only 38% of them are outside every day.
So they have a computer to spend time with.
That's right. They have a computer.
But or a phone.
What you're doing is you're taking away this potentially lifelong source of comfort and delight.
Do different people in different parts of the world have different solutions to this situation? You went to Finland. Are they approaching it the same way the Japanese and the Koreans are?
I found the Finnish to be particularly delightful about this. I felt like their approach to being in nature was sort of like Waldorf kindergarten. You know, they go out into their forest. The country is 80% forested, so it's, you know, incredible richness of forest.
It's because it's cold and people can't live there.
That's right. That's part of it. But they berry pick and they, you know, view wildlife and they love to fish and they love to swim in their cold water. And they, you know, they bring in these native hardwoods for their saunas and then they sing songs and they eat snacks and they have it's almost like a kind of childish but absolutely delightful connection they have to nature.
they have something called Mezzan Piatto?
Mezzan Piatto. I don't know how to pronounce that either. That's a term from folklore, which says that the forest and the spirits of the forest can overwhelm you and overwhelm all your senses, almost to the point of paralysis, which I think is an interesting concept, that the forest is a formidable force, that, you know, we, I think, in our culture are so disconnected from. You know, it would never occur to us that the forest, you know, can overwhelm us.
Well, so much of mythology involves forest sprites and mythical creatures, perhaps partly because the forest was also scary.
That's right. And the forest was really the source of our imaginary stories. It was really the fuel for our imaginations. And a lot of scientists posit that, you know, hey, our imaginations now are deprived because we're not spending enough time engaging all of our senses.
What is the power trail? And what was your experience on it like?
The power trail was part of a spa outside of Helsinki. It's a place where the government actually sends office workers who are depressed, unable sometimes to stay at work. They can go on the power trail, which is about a 4-kilometer hike. And there are stations along the way that just remind them to be mindful. So, you know, the title chapter is reach down and feel a plant. So they encourage you to kind of, you know, look around you, smell the foliage. And by the end of this 4 kilometers, people, you know, they take a questionnaire at the beginning and the end, and they report that they're feeling much better.
My guest is Florence Williams, who's a journalist and contributing editor to Outside Magazine, although she's also written for the New York Times and New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, among others. And her new book is The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. It is published by W.W. Norton. I would assume that you wound up at Outside because of your inclinations in this regard, that if you were more of a city person, you'd be working for New York Magazine.
That could be. Right after college, I headed out west. My first job was working for an environmental newspaper in western Colorado called High Country News. And I thought it would be a very lonely experience living in this small town in the mountains coming from New York. I was kind of a snob about it. But, you know, I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the landscape, and I didn't leave for 2 decades.
I remember meeting with a forest ranger in New Mexico who lived a pretty isolated life on a lookout. And I just couldn't imagine living that life, but she seemed to be extremely happy.
What was surprising to me about living in this small town was actually how social it was. You know, there was a lot of mixing of generations, mixing of different types of people. There was a different potluck every other night. It actually wasn't an isolating experience at all.
What was your time like in Scotland? I don't think of Scotland as a place where people are talking a lot about nature. And we're talking about a number of countries which get pretty cold.
That's true. But there is in Scotland, as in many parts of the world, a long historical and literary tradition of, you know, tromping across the moors. Also being in the forest, a lot of beautiful poetry. It was certainly the heart of the Romantic movement. Dorothy and William Wordsworth took very long walks. Even with William Coleridge, I think they even ditched him at one point and went their separate ways. So it has a very rich tradition, and it's so green. It's very lush. It's just beautiful. Now there's a program, a public policy in Scotland that says that every person has a right to live within 400 meters of a wood, of a little woodlot.
How far is 400 meters?
It's you know, less than a quarter mile, so it's quite close.
That would be rather difficult to pull off in most parts of the world.
I think it really just shows how dedicated they are to this idea that people thrive when they can get out into nature and when they can walk. Public health officials know it's incredibly important to prevent depression, prevent obesity. This is a concern that, you know, not just Americans are concerned about.
Who's Richard Mitchell, and what is he working on?
Richard Mitchell is an epidemiologist and researcher in Scotland. He's at the University of Glasgow. One of the things he's finding, he's actually looking at population-wide data, so not so much individuals or cells, but how does living next to green space affect entire populations of people? And what he's found is lower mortality when people live closer to green space, and it's not just an effect of, you know, being wealthier when you live near a park. He's found lower rates of stress-related disease, cardiovascular disease. And what he's found, this is interesting, is that it's the poorest people in society who actually seem to benefit the most and get the biggest health boost when they live close to green space.
Then there's ecotherapy. But poor people have that naturally.
Well, I guess it depends where you're living, right? If you're living under a bridge on a freeway, maybe not. Scotland is pioneering some really interesting mental health programs for patients who have recently been released from institutions. They go out into the woods. There's a program called Branching Out. It's a 12-week program. They go out for 3 hours at a time, and they do things like woodcraft art, you know, like they'll put clay gargoyles on trees, or they'll make collages with leaves. And it's really a way for people who are not comfortable in social settings to sort of begin to engage and yet also kind of do their own thing.
And then they do the scientists did experimental trials. Did you take it as well? Did you have an EEG test?
I did. I spent some time in the book wearing a portable EEG cap, which is electroencephalogram. It looks like a bathing cap. And I wore one in a number of different settings to measure my brain waves and to find out if I could get alpha by going into a natural setting. And I actually had a hard time. I tried wearing it in city parks in Washington, D.C. I was not able to get the sort of holy grail of brain states for alpha waves. It's the calm alert zone. But I was finally able to get it on a quiet lake in rural Maine. And I think for me, part of what I learned is that I am sensitive to noise pollution. And it may just be because I lived out west for 2 decades and I was kind of spoiled. But in a city, I can't quite get the full relaxation sometimes.
You talk about our epidemic dislocation from the outdoors. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that now more than half the people around the world live in cities. We are living in the middle of the largest mass migration in modern history. And it's the migration of people into cities. At the same time, it's the migration inside.
So there is a Mappiness project?
Yes, Mappiness was an app that I put on my phone. It's part of an effort to gather big data as a way to learn where people are during the day, how they feel, and what they're doing. So it pings you a couple times a day randomly. I did it for a year, so I felt like I had a pretty good data set. And I was disappointed to learn that I was only outside about 7% of the day. And it turns out that that is about an average American figure. We spend, 95% of our time either indoors or in cars.
You visited many parts of the world to accumulate your research for this book. So America doesn't match out well with other countries?
I think there's some really interesting research going on in the United States. It's a little bit different. When I visited Asia and parts of Western Europe, there was a lot of emphasis on mental health treatment, a lot of emphasis on preventative health. Of course, those are all places that where there's socialized medicine. So there's an incentive to study preventative medicine. There's a lot of funding for it. In this country, I feel like the neuroscience that's kind of most interesting right now is actually focused on sort of the opposite. It's focused on how to be more productive, how to be more creative. And it looks like, in fact, time in nature does make us more creative.
Well, New York City, every borough has at least one major park. So not everybody goes to them. But do you think that people go to them partly because they instinctively need this nature fix?
I think these parks do draw people instinctively, but I also think that we tend to undervalue the importance of nature to our well-being. We tend to think watching TV or playing video games or going shopping, we think those are things that will make us feel better. And psychologists call these forecasting errors. We're not quite accurate in what we think makes us happy.
Florence Williams' previous book was on a very different kind of topic, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. It was a New York Times notable book, 2012, winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Science and Technology. And her latest is The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Museum director and curator of medieval art might appear to be professions that offer a life mostly of aesthetic concerns without much adventure or dealings with criminals, but Gary Vican reveals in his new memoir, Sacred and Stolen Confessions of a Museum Director, that the art world is rife with thieves, forgers, smugglers, and other shady characters. And he knows firsthand because he worked at Harvard's Center for Byzantine Studies at Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C., and then as the director of the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore for nearly 20 years. His book is published by Select Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gary Vican to our show. Hello.
Great to be here, Leonard.
You grew up in a small town in northern Minnesota.
I did indeed.
How did that lead you to become an art historian, especially one who specializes in Byzantine art?
Well, the Byzantine part took a while, right? And when I say far northern Minnesota, it's 300 miles north of Minneapolis. But when I was a child, we got National Geographic. And in 1954, they did a spread in color on the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And I was totally taken with a Titian painting. And that was my introduction. I just couldn't get enough of it. I just stare at that thing.
Mm. Well, Titian is still a far cry from Byzantine art, although Venice did have a real connection to the Byzantine
empire. Because they stole everything from Constantinople, that's why.
So you studied at Princeton.
I did.
Then spent several years at Dumbarton Oaks. Were they the top places to train for your field?
Oh, absolutely. I was just really lucky. And I intersected with one of the last of the great German emigre scholars, Kurt Weizmann. And so I had a taste of that brilliance that came out of Germany, thanks to Hitler. And then I ended up at this Harvard Research Center. For 10 years, I did nothing but research and buy a few odds and ends.
And if somebody asked you, what do you want to do when you grow up, would you have said curator or a museum director?
Absolutely not. I wanted to be a scholar, but I wanted to connect with real people. And here I was at Dumbarton Oaks doing the most arcane research in my daylight time, and at night I would go down to the mall in Washington, D.C. and teach adults. And these were mostly government employees that were just hungry to recapture the excitement of their undergraduate days, and that's what really drew me into public service, really.
You write about your involvement in Dumbarton Oaks' acquisition of the an icon of St. Peter.
Right.
You have an illustration in the book.
It's huge.
Where was it from?
Well, we only found out later. But, you know, when you see an icon, and by the way, it was 3 feet tall.
Oh, that's a big head.
It's a big one. It has to be the best icon outside of the Middle East. And by the way, for those who don't know, icons are sacred images in Orthodoxy and in Byzantium. And when you're before an icon, you're actually before the deity. You speak to an icon, and it speaks back to you. Anyway.
Is that why they kind of abstract?
They're very abstract. And, of course, once you get the iconic type, it's not discarded because it is the right type. But we came across this icon in 1981, knowing on some level that it had to have come out of some church. These things don't appear in the sand. They are taken care of. So we did some looking around, but basically we didn't want to find the bad news. And only 15 years after we made the purchase did we learn that it had been smuggled out of northern Greece by having been painted over. So in other words, it was traveling incognito.
That's because you found all sorts of red paint.
Yeah, embedded in the hair.
But is that typical policy? You had concerns about its history, and yet you bought it anyway?
Yes, and realized that when I got my PhD, it was 2 years after the invasion of northern Cyprus by Turkey. And with that invasion, there was a flood on the market of Byzantine antiquities, exactly the things that I was born and trained to study. And so I intersected with that. And that was the Wild West of art buying. And you wanted not to find the bad news. And more than that, you wanted to find somebody in the country of origin who would bless your actions.
Haven't some argued, like the former, the late art dealer, Andre Emmerich, that it's okay because you're going to treat the work better than somebody else who doesn't respect it as
much? I am hugely impressed that you know this. But Andre Emmerich was famous because he said, look, if you're on the island of Paphos, right, where all this Cycladic stuff comes from, and you're digging a hole for your basement, and there's a Cycladic figurine that in the market might trade for $1.5 million, and if that's illegal for you as a farmer to own, you might just smash it. And his point of view is if you take care of it, knowing that you can sell it, it will actually come into the possession of somebody who will bring it to the public. And, you know, that's not crazy.
Yeah, well, that's the argument that the British have for keeping the Elgin marbles in the British Museum, but the Greeks would like to have it returned.
I would go one step farther. I think every human being who cares about the origin of culture and the cradle of civilization wants to see the British Museum give those marbles back and make that magnificent monument whole again.
From Dumbarton Oaks, you went to the Manil Foundation
yes.
in Houston. What was your role there?
Well, I was advisor for things Byzantine, and they got very Byzantine because at a certain point, almost by accident, I met a dealer who offered the entire interior of a 13th century church, a frescoed interior in 38 pieces.
How do you take the interior of a church and transport it to Houston?
Well, first of all, you have to have a lot of complicity in the Turkish military. You have to have a middleman in Munich. You have to have a buzzsaw, and you have to have a whole lot of rubber cement because you put rubber cement on the stuff, canvas over that, cut holes, bring it off the wall, and eventually it was reassembled by Dominique de Menil and returned now to Cyprus.
They are called the Lisi frescoes.
That's correct.
L-Y-S-I. Now, Dominique de Menil, who was, I guess, is she didn't create the Menil, did she?
Oh, yes. Yeah, she and her husband.
And you advised her on purchases?
Yes, I did.
Did
scholarship.
A number of artists have told me that that it doesn't matter. The person, the Menil, the Frick, the whatever, they are really important, the key figures, because no matter how much they're advised, they're the ones who have to ultimately pay for it. So are the ones that we should thank if something wonderful is a Vermeer is at the Frick.
Right. Or you can blame them if you want. But I think linking Dominique de Menil and Henry Clay Frick is exactly right. They're slightly different from Henry Walters, who really bought by the shipload.
But so when this happened, was this when you began to suspect that museums and other institutions engage in things that aren't always above board to build their collections?
That was my introduction, yes. And I was a player in that, and that's what my book is about. I can tell you this, that the tables have turned, and I think much for the better.
Well, in many cases, the countries involved have passed laws that say you can't engage in this kind of trade.
Right. Wealth in the ground laws. And the United States, I must say, not only by law and guidelines and practices, but by culture. You know, 20 years ago, we may have had an ashtray in front of me in this office. That's over. And the same thing is true of looting. It just is not accepted anymore.
So you say that they were returned. Has the church been rebuilt?
No. The church, while it's still standing, will almost certainly never become Orthodox again, given the political situation. So they're in a museum in Nicosia.
You write about your experiences as an expert witness in a trial in Indianapolis concerning the sale of the Kanakaria mosaics. Or did I pronounce it wrong?
Yeah, you're very close.
That again from Cyprus. What are those mosaics and why are they significant in Byzantine art?
Well, there was in Byzantium something called iconoclasm, and this was a period of more than 100 years where all images were destroyed. Isis did not invent this idea by any means. The Greeks were very good at destroying their own Christian art, and they did it with great zeal.
Because the Bible says you should not make graven images.
It's the second commandment. They had to work through that. And in the process, they destroyed vast amounts of what was the greatest era of Byzantium, the era of the great church of Hagia Sophia. But some survived, and the ones that survive are so precious because they're so rare. And these survived from, let's say, 500, the year 500, to 1978 on the wall. And then somebody came in with a hacksaw or something and cut them down, and pretty soon they're in a suburb of Indianapolis, Indiana. And there I'm in the witness box. So if you want to get that story, get the book.
And how did they wind up in Indianapolis, of all places?
Well, it was a wonderful setup. It was a beautiful setup. And the person who was set up was a small-time modern art dealer in suburban Indianapolis named Peg Goldberg. She was the tail-end Charlie, the last one in a scheme that would make a purchase. And so she was out $1 million and change because she lost.
Gary Vikan is my guest. His book, Sacred and Stolen Confessions of a Museum Director. Why did you move from Dumbarton Oaks to the Walters Art Museum, which was then known as the Walters Art Gallery?
I moved because Dumbarton Oaks has more money than it needs and no public mission. And the Walters Art Gallery then had very little money and an enormous public mission.
But you moved there as assistant director for curatorial affairs.
That's correct.
Curator of medieval art, not the most prestigious appointment.
Well, at the time, I thought it was pretty good. But I loved it because I could do exhibitions. And there's another thread in the book, and that's this quest I've been on for my entire career to bring a sense of the holy. A sense of the holy into the museum experience.
You describe some difficult situations, especially with an exhibition of Ethiopian art that you organized that drew protests. What were the protesters angry about?
They were very angry at the president of Ethiopia. But because of the repressive regime at the time, this is the early 90s, they could not act out that anger in Ethiopia, but they were free to do it in Baltimore, Maryland. And you may or may not know, but the largest Ethiopian community in the United States is 40 miles south of our museum in Baltimore.
What I do know is that when we dealt with that same issue here, yeah, we had protests as well.
Yeah,
in fact, we had the president of Ethiopia on our show, and
well,
that led to a lot of protests, yes. Then there was an so what happened to that art? Is it still?
Well, what happened to it is, 8 blocks from where we're sitting right now, much of the art that was in that show that didn't come from Ethiopia, because we brought things from American collections as well, went up for sale, and I bought it in 1996. So the Walters Art Museum right now has the finest collection of Ethiopian Christian art, and it's spectacular. Finest collection outside of Ethiopia.
And then there was an exhibition of ancient art from Georgia, which you spent a lot of time and money organizing. What happened with that show?
It was a total failure. You know, when do you ever get a 2-column headline that says, canceled? But we had great adventures, and it was with Edward Shevardnadze, the president himself, that I dealt with on that show.
Well, I mentioned earlier that, you know, it was a matter of dealing with criminals and the like. But it sounds to me like you were more engaged in international diplomacy in many of these instances.
Well, I tried.
Or are they the same people?
Yeah, I got beat up by 2 patriarchs. I mean, I don't know if I get a merit badge for that.
Physically beat up?
Well, I mean, the way academic types get beat up, you know, with words.
You became director of the Walters, a position that you held for almost 20 years. Was that job more administrative than curatorial?
No, the Walters is fairly small. And because of that, I kept my hand in all the exhibition and programming of the museum, and I loved it, and acquisitions as well.
So when something comes your way, you know this is a really terrific piece, but you also have questions about how it got there. How do you deal with that?
Well, nowadays you can do something you could not do in 1983, and that's put it on the internet. And if there's any solution to the issue of looting, it's candor and transparency. Put it up there. If somebody has evidence that it's stolen, let them come forward. Negotiate its return if you must. Otherwise, you have title and get on with your life.
Do you contact the governments that might apply and say
yes.
And ask them to prove that this is something that was obtained illegally?
I don't ask them to prove it. I tell you what, we were given a collection of art from Yemen, South Arabian art, about Roman period. And two of the pieces we were given are on postage stamps still issued by the country. So I thought they may want these back. So I went to the embassy in Washington, showed them the pieces, reminded them about the stamps, and he blessed the gift. Hmm. And in fact, the ambassador came to the opening and he said, we are so pleased that the culture of our country is on view in the United States.
On the other hand, Native Americans in this country are often really upset at the fact that so much of their cultural legacy is in museums in the East.
Right, as they should be upset. And I think the National Repatriation Act that's now almost 30 years old, 25 years old, is something that acknowledged that hurt. And I think deals in a very grown-up and fair way.
In addition to worrying about whether the art in your museum was stolen, you also had to deal with an actual theft of some 145 pieces.
Right, by the night security officer. You know, 145.
He was the guy who was supposed to protect the collection.
Over 2 weeks, he took out 145 orcs, including two flintlock rifles. Now, and he didn't drive. He lived 4 miles from the museum. He had these wooden boards that he glued together, hollowed out. So he stuck the rifles inside the boards, put the cap back on, and walked 4 miles from the museum to his home.
How did you find out who had taken them?
Well, I think everybody, the FBI knew from the beginning that two things had to be true. They had to have access and leisure time. And this guy had access and leisure time. As it turned out, he had almost a sexual attraction to the works themselves.
So he wasn't trying to sell them?
Oh, no. He wanted to escape to Costa Rica, build a Chinese hut, and handle this stuff. I met up with him 26 years after the theft. I tracked him down on the internet, and I invited him out for a glass of wine. I wanted to hear his side of the story. And you know what he said? Last thing he said to me, he said, I love to fondle it.
As the director, you got rid of the museum's admission fee.
Yes, that's a good example for lots of museums in lots of cities.
So how do you pay the way? Is it just totally rich people giving you money and down?
Well, there are many. Think of the museum as like a bathtub.
You ever think of going on the air and doing all the money in half the time?
Yeah, that's a lot of that. But there are a lot of sources of money and a lot of expenses. And if you set your sights on public service, the question you're going to ask is, how far can I push that admission fee down and still run this museum? And you can be absolutely certain that there's a lot of distance between most ticket prices at most museums in this country and that point where it would really hurt.
Do you follow what goes on at other museums, like the turmoil now at the Metropolitan, which is one of the greatest museums in the world?
It is, I think, the greatest museum in the world.
But if they offered you the job, would you take it?
One, I'm too old. Two, I'm much too candid.
Well, you've retired from the museum. In an afterward, you write about your feelings of how to deal with artifacts currently coming out of war-ravaged countries. That's the ones that aren't destroyed by ISIS.
That's exactly right. And because they can escape that region, I think we should treat them as refugees. I think we should welcome them to our shores. I think we should give them safe harbor. And when that region of the world calms down, give them back.
Well, the museums in Iraq were looted after Saddam Hussein was toppled from power.
Right.
Are those pieces still turning up?
They are. There are probably 14,000, mostly small items, still out. And every now and then one will pop up. These are cuneiform tablets, cylinder seals, small items, low-end items mostly now. But I can tell you one thing. Very little is coming out of Syria or Iraq now. Very, very little. And the contrast between that and what was going on in the 80s out of northern Cyprus is amazing.
Do you consider the dealers culpable? Dealers who didn't steal them but are offering them as middlemen?
I think dealers nowadays are becoming as concerned as collectors and museums, because an honest trade in antiquities can only exist when that ecosystem all plays by a set of transparent rules.
You have since retired.
Yes.
Any plans for going back into the field?
No. I see you're smiling.
Well, maybe the Met will call.
I don't think so. Do you want me to give them my number?
Just give it to my producer and okay. We'll pass it on.
Thank you so much.
Gary Vikan, V-I-K-A-N. His book, Sacred and Stolen Confessions of a Museum Director, is published by Select Books. What a great pleasure it's been talking with
you. Fantastic.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.